Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. Panel here raring to go. Let's have a quick look at the front pages first. So the Sunday Times have the thing we all talk about that we then give out about talking about because we pretend we don't want to talk about it, but then we talk about it again. Simon Harris, I'll talk election dates after the budget is the headline there. Now, that is based, I should say, on when asked if he would discuss the election date with the other coalition leaders after the budget, he said, I imagine we will, yes. So that's that. He does say November 15th doesn't align with when I believe the next general election would be. There seems to be a kind of an unwillingness to say yes or no here. Anyway, we'll get into that. There's a big interview with him there on other topics as well. Now, the Sunday Independent is leading with shocking snag list revealed at troubled National Children's Hospital. And this is kind of blown up overnight, really. And it's we've had these big public spats between the government and BAM, the company who are building the National Children's Hospital before. So as you know, the completion date has been moved again now. The hospital will now not be occupied until 2026. It feels like this story is saying not one of 3,000 rooms are finished to standard and work priced at 25 million done by other firm for 200k. I should say BAM have been on to us with big long statements and all kinds of things, but they do absolutely deny that. And there is claim and counterclaim as well on both sides as to the extent of what a snag list is, should be, and when a room is finished and when it isn't. But we'll get into that. The Irish Mail on Sunday, Gardaí tried to seize RTE riot footage. So it seems like the Gardaí tried to get the footage from the Primetime Investigates programme the other night from the reporter Barry O'Kelly before they came to RTE looking for it. So they went to his house with an order and they couldn't find him there. And then they came to RTE, but he was gone out of the office and everything. But RTE, as we know, are now handing them over that footage. The Business Post, McKillen Jr. moves to LA after he loses control of the press up empire. The Mirror, never again. And that's the continuing conversation around the awful death of Aoife Johnston in UHL. And the Sun on Sunday says that bully row Zara McDermott returned to Strictly last night. And to some of you, that you will understand the significance of that, but I'm not getting into it right now. So our panel, Dan Mulhall is a former Irish ambassador to the United States. Sinead O'Carroll is editor of the journal.ie. Gerard Howland is a public affairs advisor and Irish Times columnist. And Sinead McSweeney is former global VP of public policy with Twitter and a current student. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Gerard, did you look at the Simon Harris interview in the Sunday Times?
I did.
He'll talk election dates after the budget.
And the reason I believe, and I genuinely believe, the party leaders have not talked about this is that none of them dares to be the one to utter the first words that could then be quoted by the others as being their position on when it should be had. So I think there is a Mexican standoff between the party leaders on this. I think it is all to be decided.
Does it look like desperation if you say you want to have an election? Does it make you weak?
It puts you in danger of being blamed for a position that you don't want to be solely accountable for.
And while they all want to have an election before Christmas?
I don't see the personally, but I won't be asked, I won't be in the conversation. I don't see the benefit of going much longer after the budget, but the only people who count are the leaders, and some of those leaders count more than others. They have not talked to each other. They haven't really said what they actually think, nor, by the way, if they had a jot of cop on, would they? And that's where it's at. They haven't talked, they haven't decided, and we don't know. So it's all opinion.
So you'd be talking to people now, I suppose, more so in Fianna Fáil, your alma mater, so to speak, than maybe the other parties.
Oh, I talk to lots of people.
Yeah.
And some people in Fianna Fáil don't talk to me.
Really? Okay.
It's a mixed scene.
Okay. So in this mixed scene, what's the impression you're getting as to what people want and B, what will happen?
Well, Sinead O'Carroll can talk to this. This is all political anoraks talking to each other and shouldn't be taken very seriously because the people who know aren't in the conversation.
Okay.
Sorry to burst that balloon. But some people are more important than others.
Sinead O'Carroll, it's 7 minutes past 11. It's early to burst the balloon. Would you reinflate it there, please?
You're right. The it's only the political talking class that cares about this kind of pre-election talk. When's it going to be? I actually was talking...
I think people are enjoying it, to be honest. It's a no consequences kind of, you know, bit
yeah,
of stuff.
And Hugh...
There's
Hugh,
all such awful news out there that this is, you know...
It's like a competition. It's like Strictly Come Dancing that you didn't want to talk about. Like, who will win? Hugh O'Connell has a line that, like, if you're talking about electoral success in elections, but you can look at, Simon Harris can look at his popularity and that he's done a lot for Fine Gael in the polls, but actually the problems of the country are as intractable as ever. So that's speaking to your point, that actually if we just talk about party politics, you can kind of see changes and you can see wins and losses for particular people, but actually the problems remain there.
Oh, don't you worry. Bide your time. We will talk about the problems of the country. I'm just trying to ease into it.
I was talking to an ordinary person yesterday and they would not be a traditional Fine Gael voter, but really admire Simon Harris. And because he has been saying for so long that they will go to end of term, meaning next year. Now, he didn't say next year in today's interview, but he has kind of consistently said next year.
Hang on. I'm going to tell you what end of term means. Full term, according to his definition today, was the government completing its body of work, that's a new take on the job of work, and having gone as close to the constitutional date as makes sense and is viable, i.e. any time between November and...
Whenever I February, want, March, really, yeah. is what he's saying. But this person thought that they would see it as a lie if Simon Harris went now before next year, because he has been saying it for so long. So that's one perspective, but I thought it was an interesting one, that if you say something enough times, people will believe you, and if they like you, they want to continue to believe you.
Conventional wisdom on that has been that if they need to do a U-turn, they'll think of something and people will get over it after a day.
But my comment on this would be, I'm not a politician, but I've been observing politics for a long, long time, is, does it make a difference? I mean, we're not talking about a government going halfway through its term or, you know, calling a snap election after 2 years in office. We're talking about a government that's now been 4 years and X months, and we're talking about the difference between mid-November and mid-January or mid-February and this Christmas in between. So what are we talking about here? This is a very small issue
A mere student, now you're a long time observer of politics. A lot can happen between November and January, can't it? And bad things can happen.
Absolutely. Go back to the early 1990s and you can see exactly how much Bertie Ahern, I'm sure, would tell you how much can happen between November and January. My view is that it will be a spring election. That's my sense of it. Similar to what Sinead just said, that individual they were talking to yesterday, I think that, like, we've a constant process story right now about the date of the election. But if the election was called for November, I think the first week of that would be something more than a process story, which would be a story about trust. Because they were so emphatic in the early days that about the dates. I know the language is getting woolly now. And I think there's a huge danger in that, because the biggest problem we have with politics right now is trust. And that's why we're seeing lots of other problems manifesting themselves across society.
Jordan, would anybody really care? Would anybody really care if the government called an election for the middle of November? Would that be a big issue on the minds of voters? Would it be more important to them than the cost of living, than, you know, immigration, than jobs, than the economy and so forth? I don't think it would be. I think this would be a thing that would be forgotten overnight.
I don't think timing of an election would be a big public issue, Dan, but I think it will matter tactically to parties, and with small margins would be incredibly important to the ultimate outcome. Mm. And one reason, by the way, and go back to 2016 and the end of the Enda Kenny, Joan Barton, Labour Fine Gael coalition, one reason, perhaps the main reason it may ultimately go to the spring, is because they cannot agree among themselves to go earlier. And that's what happened between Labour and Fine Gael in 2016. Fine Gael wanted to go earlier. Labour wouldn't agree. They went later, and the rest is history. And timing did not matter to the public, but by God, did it matter to those parties.
Okay, who do you think wants to go later and who wants to go earlier?
I'm not sure. I think the Greens don't have much of an incentive to go earlier. I think they're very focused on, you know, getting as much done in terms of the climate change actions they have in hand as possible. As between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, I think the vast majority of their own TDs who are piped up and het up and ready to go. They want to go as much as out of psychological need and necessity.
Yeah. But of course, you don't even have candidates in some
That's only half of Fine Gael's.
Precisely. Yeah. And I think the big, Sinead, you're right. Yeah. And I think the big issue for Fine Gael is it doesn't matter how well the leader is doing or the party is doing, are 16 brand new candidates sufficiently grounded in the constituency, or could they be left behind after a campaign that went prematurely?
Is there a question of government formation to Jared? I'm kind of throwing this question out with no answer, but like, if we have a 15th of November election, government formation is not going to be straightforward unless they concede pretty early that they're hoping for a Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil reboot. And then you're doing that over Christmas in January.
Well, the big thing about the government formation is it's a doll with 14 extra seats. So it's not enough for Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael to do reasonably well. They have to do very well because there's going to be a gap between them and a majority. It's unlikely there'll be one entity called the Greens with 12 seats that can fill the gap in one piece. It'll probably take several mix or mash of independents or smaller parties, and that will be a very complicated process.
Dan, Owen O'Malley has an interesting piece in the Sunday Independent today. Martin paints Fianna Fáil into an election corner by brushing off Sinn Féin.
Yeah, I mean, look, for me, as someone who observes politics across Europe, everywhere else in Europe at the moment, being an incumbent carries a huge handicap. It gives you, it weighs you down. Look at Macron, look at Scholz in Germany, look at Rishi Sunak, who was wiped out at the last election in the UK. And Ireland seems to be bucking the trend there, where the actual incumbent parties in government, and one of them has been government since 2011, after all, don't seem to be suffering the kind of blows of incumbency elsewhere.
It has
in
been
Europe.
Mentioned the magic trick of making Simon Harris look like the change candidate.
Yeah, but I mean, look, my experience going back many years has been that the election is held, the people deliver their verdict, and then the politicians have to deal with that verdict, whatever it might be. And I've seen people criticise and say, oh, you know, Fianna Fáil ruled out a coalition with Fine Gael before the last election, therefore this government's illegitimate. No, it's not. A government is legitimate if it has a majority in the Dáil and it can elect a Taoiseach. That's what a government requires. And whatever combination is required is what will have to come about after the election.
And again, everyone gets over it after a day. I suppose, though, Gerard, the person who mightn't get over it, if Fianna Fáil and Sinn Féin did end up going into government together, it puts Micheál Martin on a sticky wicket, does it? Like, he did emphatically rule it out again this week. The first time he's done it that emphatically in a while, I think.
Well, Owen O'Malley's column in the Sunday Independent is good on this. It's the diametrical opposite of what Eamon Ryan did for the Greens. He's clear, and I presume Roderick O'Gorman is equally clear, that they will negotiate with whoever. Micheál Martin has backed himself into a corner in that respect. On one hand, he's saying to people, if you vote for us, you are certain Sinn Féin will not be in the ring with us. He said that, funnily enough, about Fine Gael, I think, before the last election as well, but anyway, don't want to be cynical. But in what he has done, I think he's made it easier for Fine Gael to deal with him. Subsequently, even if the numbers were there, he doesn't have any other
he's
options.
Cut off an option,
You know, the best person who ever did a deal was Dick Spring with Albert Reynolds in 92-93. Why? He kept them both, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil. He had them both within arm's reach. He had real leverage just between one and the other.
Yeah, Owen O'Malley has a line here as well, right? Just listen to this carefully now. Ruling out Sinn Féin, he says, means ruling in Fine Gael. This begs the question of why not just give your vote directly to Fine Gael? And we could have a point there. Sinead, will the government be whatever the government needs to be after the election? Everyone will do business with whoever they need to do business with.
Yeah, and if Sinn Féin are...
Sinead Maxarini, I will
sorry.
I think Sinead O'Carron may have more expertise on this, but I mean, yeah, I think that is very often the reality, and as Gerard says, we've seen that in elections past, and we've ended up with some really strong and good governments afterwards. I mean, on the other hand, like, what's interesting here is that we're kind of being critical of somebody for giving an emphatic answer to a question, and then, you know, on the other side, we criticise politicians for being woolly in their answers to questions. So we're never really happy.
Yeah, Sinead, you were going to say?
I was just going to say, because also it's not just parties dealing with each other, it's they have to deal with the civil service as well. So we will see if there are parties who haven't been in government recently or get in for the first time, that it's not always just dealing with your own people, dealing with the electorate, it's also dealing with your departments.
Okay. By the way, before we leave, anything else interesting in the Simon Harris interview? Did he say anything else worth noting or anything?
There was an added emphasis on the issue of migration.
Yeah.
It wasn't an emphatic statement, but I felt it was an added emphasis on the need for migration to be socially justified in terms of social cohesion and for people's worth and value.
What did he say?
So his exact words, he drew, and I'm quoting the author, he draws a link between the surge in immigration and rising homelessness, saying, quote, very serious volume of people coming to the country is now having a real impact, unquote. It's not a point he has been as explicit about before. It is one he returns to later in the interview.
Could he be said to be blaming the housing crisis on?
No, I don't read it as starkly as that.
Okay.
I think it is a difference of emphasis and nuance. And I think he's highlighting the fact that there are so many people, so many houses, so many resources. I don't think he's whistleblowing.
Okay.
I read it.
Sinead McSweeney, you
were. Yeah, I mean, I actually interviewed the Taoiseach a couple of weeks ago at the Kennedy Summer School. So a lot of what's in this interview, he said on stage at that. And I take it as him saying, on the one hand, that the issues are more complex than we would like to believe they are. But he's also, I think he's reaching out to people who have questions, worries, concerns in a way which says, we hear you, but you know, those views may or may not always be acceptable. Like, there's just something about his language which I find interesting in terms of he's trying to walk away or turn away from the very binary setting people up against each other when it comes to complex issues, which is what you have to do to deal with the kind of misinformation that's being peddled by various right-wing activists. So I think he is, you know, relatively successfully walking the line that, you know, world leaders have to now walk
in order to ensure the people who are feeling disenfranchised but would not give any quarter to.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Dan, you wanted to come in there.
He's pointing to the very obvious fact that there now are constraints on our capacity to cope with a rapidly increasing population. We've seen the population increase quite dramatically in recent years. And you need to be able to...
He mentioned specifically people looking for protection here. And it does feel like that we have been encouraged all the time not to blame, quote, those people for the shortage of resources here, that it is a separate issue.
Well, we have to be more effective, more efficient in the way we deal with these claims and then deal with them and move on. But we have to distinguish between the various kinds of immigration we have. We have European citizens coming here who are entitled to live and work here. We have people coming here legally with visas to work here because we need their labour and we need their skills. And then we have people coming here looking for protection. And we have to distinguish between those three types of people. Rather than talking about closing the borders or sending people home, these are sort of populist slogans that have no reality. I mean, have no capacity to be realised in the real world.
Okay, just before we move on,
I think there is a tightrope there on the wider thing, but on this specific mention of homelessness linked to migration, inward migration to the country, I think there was a little bit of cynicism there because the interviewer, Hugh O'Connell, was putting to him that homelessness continues to get worse under his 13 years, and as Taoiseach, it has continued to get worse, and he is putting a context on that, saying some of those numbers are because of the increase. So I think you do have to have a cynical brain on when you're reading exactly what the questions he was answering there as well.
Okay, now that does bring us in a way to another big issue during the week, which is, I suppose, the basis of it was the RT Investigates programme on Thursday night. Sinead, kind of, I think on this, you picked about Minister McEntee confirming her plans for hate speech laws now dropped in the Sunday Independent, but that story has been everywhere in the last.
I thought it was unusual timing. It was obviously a decision that had been made and they had spoken through that there wasn't consensus for the hate speech elements of the bill. But actually, I think a lot of people watching on Thursday may have seen good reason for why hate speech and incitement to hatred is an important part of legislation in most other countries in Europe.
Because now, we have hate speech legislation, we keep being told.
We don't have incitement to hatred, and these are it is a tightrope, again, to use that phrase, to not police opinion and not to police free speech, as people call it, but also to make sure that if crimes are carried out or there is incitement to hatred because of someone's race or ethnicity, that is actually actionable by Gardaí and by the DPP. We saw the huge reaction to Thursday was, why weren't the guards doing anything? Why haven't there been arrests? Why haven't the court cases happened in a timely manner regarding these incidents or incidents that were even before this last November? And part of that is that we don't have the correct legislation. We saw Pat Leahy, the assistant commissioner, say that some of the correct legislation isn't there. It's just a really difficult job. Yeah, so that's why you have people being able to say things like the N-word and the C-word to people of colour while they are just doing their jobs.
Yeah, Sinead, it did seem to a lot of people that the timing was strange, because maybe for the first time a lot of people thought, Jesus, maybe this should be against the law to do this.
Yeah, I mean, I personally am not comfortable with the concept of hate speech legislation, which probably wouldn't come as a surprise, having worked for Twitter for 12 years.
Why?
Because I think it's that tension between policing speech and policing behaviour. And so I think that, as we have in the current legislation, you have given crimes, whether they're public order offences, assault, whatever, which then are seen to be exacerbated by a hate element rather than having a specific...
That's the piece of the legislation that is going through.
Yes.
And I think a lot of people, it's being talked about as if, well, that was the non-contentious piece. I think a lot of people thought, well, that's going to be a tricky one. How do you impute motive of hatred and stuff? But is it not reasonably straightforward that somebody who is screaming, like, not quite in someone's face, but screaming like, you are an N, you're not wanted here, why don't you go home, look at you, you're a different breed, all this kind of stuff. Should the guards not be able to arrest that person?
But they should be able to arrest them now. Like, that's assault. But it's a public order offence. So, again, I think, you know, like, looking at the programme the other night, I mean, there are elements there which constituted public order offences, where, you know, the Gardaí should be in evidence gathering mode, people should be arrested subsequently, put before the courts. I mean, there's a list in one of the papers, and I can't bring it to hand now, listing all of the arson attacks that we've had in the last 12 and how few of them have arrests. And so I think that's a challenge. These individuals need to see that there are consequences for their actions, whereas right now, unfortunately, they seem to be behaving with impunity.
And the Tarnisher himself said a thing a lot of people have been saying for the last few weeks. He said, look, people looked at it in England, how quickly they acted. And there were people who kind of seemed shell-shocked by the fact that they were suddenly being sent to prison for 3 years. Like,
Within a week.
Even professional far-righters or whatever.
Yeah.
Come here. So we should mention, you've worked for the PSNI and you've also worked for the Gardaí down here. So you have a certain expertise in this kind of thing.
Well, knowledge anyway.
We call it knowledge. more than the rest of us anyway, right? So there were interesting things in it, right? And I think, look, okay, the overall thing was people looking at it going, why are these people not being arrested, right, in a lot of the situations? There was one thing in particular that struck a lot of people, which is that when Barry O'Kelly was up in Newtown Mount Kennedy, he was standing next to a line of public order Gardaí, and he was clearly, Pat Leahy, they said in the programme, the guard, Pat Leahy, is against the journalist. That was an assault. He was being shoved, he was being pushed, his camera, he was being knocked over. The Gardaí stood, you wouldn't say impassively, like, but they were standing right next to him and they ignored it. Now, the commissioner said that was the right thing for them to do.
Yeah, I agree with the commissioner. I mean, I've lots of respect for Pat Leahy. He was a fabulous guard. He did amazing work when he was in Store Street and all of that. But I would disagree with Pat on his analysis of that one particular incident. And I mean, that was a public order line, and it's called a line for a reason. So it shouldn't break. That public order line shouldn't break. There was also two uniform guards which passed in the background, which the journalist referred to. I think I mean, I would have had experience of this, particularly in Northern Ireland around the 12th, where journalists doing their job and rightfully doing their job, covering what is happening on the ground, both from the point of view of people who are intent on engaging in disorder, but also whether police are using their powers appropriately, are there to report on what's happening. But what they need to realise is if you get that close to the public order line, you're not just reporting on the story, you're part of the story.
Okay. And okay. Well, if the guards get into criticism of this journalist who did, I think, job in illuminating things.
Absolutely.
But let's talk about the guards' reaction to it. So why they're right not to help that person who is
because
under attack.
Because the group people don't necessarily come to those incidents intent on rioting, but there will be a few who are. What they need then is to gather sufficient support from the crowd to create a full-scale riot. And so they are looking for those sparks or flashpoints. So a guard moving in to deal with that incident creates the spark to encourage another 10, 15, 20 people. And then what you have done is the actions of the guards have caused the public order incident.
Okay. And so this is at the heart, you know, I think, of a lot of the tension around how people feel the guards are behaving in this situation. Obviously, there was a situation in Coolock where the guards just weren't there for hours of it. Yeah. And the commissioner said that was wrong. But there has been, over the last year or so, people saying, why are the guards standing back so much and leaving these people at it? You're saying that this is actually the right approach to this.
Yes. I mean, each individual incident has to be judged on its merits. But like, we had this for years in Northern Ireland. Now, what we used to do was we would hold press conferences the following day and we would actually explain the public order tactics after the event, or in the run up to the 12th, we would have press conferences and press briefings before the incident to say, this is what a graduated response looks like. This is what it means if the police line is doing this. This is what it means if they take the following action, and explaining evidence gathering and the subsequent prosecution that would take place.
So at what point do the guards act? Is there a point at which they have to act?
Again, it depends. Like, threat to life and property would be one of the elements. But again, you have to judge in the moment what exacerbates the situation and what contains the situation. And that's different. Like, every crowd has its own literally psychological makeup and mindset.
Gerard, what did you make of what we saw on that programme and the discussion around it?
Yeah, what mesmerises me is what is going on inside your own head that you'd be out there involved in this. I'm trying to understand where these people are coming from, because you can't have any sort of a dialogue, ultimately, that's political and social. Down in Newtown, Mount Kennedy, close to midnight, on a cold night, shouting, roaring and abusing. We all know ourselves that when we make a smart remark, a belittling remark, it's about us letting ourselves down. It speaks to our own inadequacy rather than the hurt we're trying to inflict the person we're speaking to. And this is that on a monumental scale, such as the virulence of what is being said, the riots and so forth. And I think it's important that the police do their best, but this is not a policing issue ultimately. We will not police this issue away. This is a new phenomenon.
Will we not? Like, does it not seem as if there is a small hardcore... Sinead McSweeney just said there will be a bunch of people at any of these things intent on causing trouble. It seems like we've known who these people are for a long time now. Like, is there no... I think people are starting to think, is there no way these elements can be like rounded up and taken off the pitch?
I'm sure there's ways and means in which, you know, some people can be rounded up and taken off the pitch. But the dynamic that's out there in some quarters that ranges from hate to disgruntlement to uneasiness to apathy, the full gamut of that range, that is not going to be policed away. Right. Our society has changed more intensely in the last 20 years than it did at any time since the famine, and that is causing stress and strain, and it requires a better understanding and a better response than simply policing, which of course can always be done better.
Hate speech would be one way to take them off the pitch, but that has obviously been taken off the pitch now, because these people do go online and spew hate very, very, very regularly.
Yeah.
But I think the frustration in this, I think a lot of people will hear Sinead talk about the common sense approach to public order and be nodding. But I think the frustration comes from the bigger picture, because it's not just the incidents that people feel like nothing's been done. It's the arson attacks. It's the hate speech online. It's the general atmosphere around these things. And it's
a lot of arrests have come out of Coolock, the Gardaí have pointed out, and they are continuing
to
arrest.
Yeah, but the slow process through the courts the end outcomes are slow. But I think there's also an element of our political class and talking heads like us also putting a very polite, concerned citizen face on some of this. So I think for the first time on Thursday, that some of that was taken away.
Okay, Maria Cahill asks any specific people.
No, not at all. Maria Cahill is asking a question in her piece in the Sunday Independent. Is a concerned citizen complicit in what follows if they allow a peaceful protest to be hijacked by miscreants? And I would go further and say, if you're someone who is putting the under-resourcement or the problems of certain towns onto a protest against people coming in, then are you looking at the wrong thing? Why aren't you questioning yourself of why have you not protested before when the GP moved out? Why have you not protested before over certain things not happening? Have you gone to the constituency office of your TD?
Is there an element of those things happen gradually and this is happening suddenly to towns and people
or
are...
On the disenfranchisement question, have you supported things that help with that, such as different justice issues, more means testing on budget measures? Like these are the questions we should be asking when people talk about immigration.
One of the things that concerned me reading the papers this morning was a story in the Mail on Sunday talking about the fact that the main parties now fear far-right no-go zones, and they fear intimidation and violence during the coming election campaign, whether it be in November or in January, February. And that's a disturbing development. I mean, for 100 plus years...
And we saw in that programme, Fine Gael local election candidate, the treatment that man was getting and his dignity, you'd have to say, in the face of it, but good.
And the other point that was made there is that the parties are unclear how to deal with this problem. Mm-hmm. And remember, in Britain, the last number of years, you know, a number of members of Parliament have actually been killed by two people, so I mean, this is a serious development, and it's so out of tune with the history of Irish democracy, where we've had this sort of civil democracy, you know, not always perfect in its outcomes, but certainly always conducted in a civil fashion, even during the Troubles, even in the aftermath of the Civil War 100 years ago. We managed to have civil conversations with each other, and if we're now in a position where people are afraid to go out and campaign, I mean, I remember a time when people would say, oh, nobody ever knocked on my door. People actually wanted to have candidates knock on their doors to talk to them and tell them what they thought about, you know, the issues of the day. So I think it would be a terrible thing for Ireland if this kind of thing, you know, changed our political culture and made us into a fearful country, fearful of the kind of intimidation that people like this are capable of unleashing.
I'm just thinking now as you speak of that man, I mean, take down the poster now. There's a couple of thugs standing around. Take it down now while we're standing here. Take down the humiliation and belittlement of the person as well. Before we leave this, Sinead McSweeney, I'm not going to make you a spokesman for the big tech every time you're in here, right? But just something jumped out there with Sinead O'Carroll saying people spewing hate online, right? It's a very simple phrase. It is true, like, you would say that, we can't stop that, you can't make laws against that.
You can stop it, and there are laws against it, and most of the platforms have rules against it.
But do they work? So, are they working in the incarnation?
Well, sorry,
of
you can
now?
Laugh. You can laugh all you like, but I mean, the abuse that I received on social media was because all of those people were taken off Twitter when I was there. The reason that I have security on my home was because those people were taken off Twitter when I was there, just because a new owner has put them back on.
Was it a simple calculus for you to take people off, or did you have to think long and hard about the idea of
They were breaking our rules, just as they break the rules on other platforms and are removed from those platforms. But, you know, I think we're not going to... Actually, one of the founders of Twitter, Biz Stone, had a phrase when he used to talk about teams trying to work together, which was trust that your colleagues are smart and have good intentions. And I actually think it's a phrase that we should bring into an awful lot of our public discourse about the problems that we have, that actually most people come to a table, whether it's civil servants, whether it's the people who are, you know, knocking on tents along the canal to see if people are okay, whether it's politicians, that actually the vast majority of people get up in the morning wanting the world to be a better place. And if we had less cynicism about that, if we empathise with people more, and if we respected where people were coming from, we would actually go a lot further to solve some of these problems.
Okay, I want to take a break and let people digest that there. Okay, Dan Mulhall, Sinead O'Carroll, Gerard Howland and Sinead McSweeney staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel is still with us. Dan Mulhall, Sinead O'Carroll, Gerard Howland and Sinead McSweeney. Now, Sinead O'Carroll, this story on the front of the Sunday Independent, shocking snag list revealed a troubled NCH. And obviously, look, there are claims and counterclaims here, and we will be fair to everybody as we go through it. But roughly speaking, the overview here is that this is another massive row breaking out between the Minister for Health, the government, the Minister for Health personified in him, and BAM.
Yeah, and the National Paediatric Hospital Development Board. So the Sunday Independent have this day. The Irish Times had kind of the start of the row yesterday. So Fiona Sheehan's writing that none of the 3,000 rooms finished so far in the building were completed to accepted an acceptable standard. That's according to the Minister for Health. BAM are saying absolutely not. There's just a snag list like there usually is. The upshot is that the hospital is going to be delayed again. We're looking at 2026 for patients, May 2025.
No, it's a bigger picture why it's going to be delayed.
Yeah. And we're looking at a cost of 2.2 billion. Euro. The crux of the debate or the fight that we'll hear more of in the Oireachtas this week is BAM keeps saying that it's the design specifications kept changing, therefore they kept having to spend money and they kept having to go back and redo things or do things to a different specification and therefore that was the time and money.
I'll just give an input on that. There have been, at the end of April 2024, 23,283 revised design drawings to BAM following the initial technical submission exercise. Now, we don't know what the norm for a complex project is, but it does seem that, and I think everyone has admitted, that the job was started before the design was finalised and there have been a number of changes in the design.
Yeah, and then going to try and get into the insight into one of those, the Minister says, but is absolutely rejected from BAM, and they say that some of the allegations left against them are incorrect and misleading and ill-informed. But the Minister said that there was an example that BAM quoted 25 million for work.
BAM, yeah, and BAM absolutely
rejected. But they say that the Minister for Health says another contractor completed the work for 200,000 euro. So they're the kind of things that we'll hear more about when we hopefully get
claims on both sides. Yeah. BAM in particular, they said this morning to us, rejects the claim by the minister that BAM is seeking in any way, and this is the minister's quotes, to extract as much money from the Irish taxpayer as possible and is holding the state to ransom. So they reject that claim as well. Gerard Howland, the last time that the row got this heated, BAM said, okay, we'll walk away. If the government wants to get someone else to finish this, we'll walk away. Mm. Which was in effect them saying, like, look, grand, find someone else to do it. There aren't many builders of this scale equipped to do a job like this.
I presume getting somebody in at this very late stage on a project of that size would be, to put it mildly, difficult, if not impossible. There's also the fact that there was a report recently about what sums of money might settle the differences, and apparently it's all going to the courts. You're in a downward spiral. Relations are, to put it mildly, poor.
No, it is normal that there would be claims. As a job changes, there would be claims made. Those claims are disputed. There is an arbitrator appointed normally. It is some of it does appear to be going to the High Court at this stage, but that is part of any big project.
So the only thing that's different here is the scale and vehemence. And the scale and vehemence of all this seems to be disproportionate to most other major jobs, where, of course, lots of snags, lots of challenges, lots of issues around big money. And this all goes back to the design and build format that was decided on years ago. A decision was taken to build, then it was a design. The amount of leverage that the hospital board, the authority set up to manage this project, has under this contract is quite limited. They're in before the one of the Oireachtas committees, the health committee, I think, during the week. There's a sort of well-trodden format that they're bashed around by people who are ultimately responsible for the administrative state that, of course, set up this contract, which has never been used again, never will be, and it's not fit for purpose. So we're in, if you like, the last lap that's become increasingly more difficult, increasingly tortured, of a process that should never have been started in that way, on those terms and conditions. And the political context of this was that after the debacle of the Children's Hospital project imploding at the Mater site, there was a rush to do something somewhere. And that was one of the outcomes of that, to make progress. But in making progress, too much haste was employed. And from that is the origin of this.
OK. And would it seem to you then that there's going to be obviously performative outrage and claim and counterclaim on both sides here? But really, they'll have no choice but to settle down again and move on in the job.
If you have a kitchen extension and, you know, your sewage is not right, what are your chances of getting in another builder to fix your problem? Are you going to sit on your sewage problem in your extension? You know, this is that on a grand scale and much, much more complex. But possession, if not 9/10 of the law, I think is a significant part of the issue.
Sinead McSweeney, as someone who's worked in big business and everything, what's your view on all this?
I mean, like it is mind-boggling, and it's hard to comprehend on so many levels, the length of time it's taking, the cost, the kind of what appear to be overruns against original budgets. But the end of the day, who is suffering? It's the people who need the service, the staff who are working in poor conditions in the existing hospitals. I mean, I've been in the site. I'm on the board of the Children's Health Foundation, which is the charity that fundraises for the children's hospitals. It's incredibly impressive. I have to say, it was very busy the day I was there. There was plenty of workers in and out there. But the reality is, the longer it takes to build it, the more out of date it's going to be. I mean, if you look at advances in, medical technology and treatments, etc., we're potentially losing time here. But that said, I mean, the intake, the emergency room setup, and the triaging and everything is just hugely, hugely impressive.
Everyone agrees it's going to be amazing built and designed like a shopping centre in Dubai, by all accounts. Curves, practically double the price of any bit of building, a builder told me. Dan?
Well, I mean, look, my view on these things is that we really need to get our act together on this kind of project, because if you look at the numbers that are being quoted about the kind of budgetary surpluses that we're generating, we have a lot of resources that we can plough into infrastructure and developments of this kind, and we really need to make sure that we get it right. Now, having said that, when I was in Germany, the big new airport in Berlin was about to open in 2012, and embassies were brought out to view the facilities out there, because it was going to be opening within a few months. It took 10 more years to open because they discovered problems that delayed the project for 10 years. So these things are not unique to Ireland. But I do think, given the amount of potential we have now to build and develop the infrastructure of the country, we do need to get on top of this whole issue of how to design and roll out projects of this nature.
And even more than that, and it sounds like an asinine statement, but like, we need to get better at spending money. Like, one of the figures that popped out for me from the Sunday Independent was around 600 million in claims from BAM have still to be assessed and resolved. So how many of the euros that we've spent on this have actually been litigated and relitigated? And will this happen in another big infrastructure project, which we need to do with the billions that are coming our way from an escrow account?
OK, so we'll stay with money, and obviously the budget coming up in 9 days. I mean, you barely bother talking about what's going to be in the budget at this stage. Will we talk instead, Gerard, about Sinn Féin in the Irish Mail on Sunday? Their alternative budget, which the Mail on Sunday seems to have had sight of, they will abolish USC below €45,000. Yeah, they hated USC.
They hated USC, yeah, which of course pays for things like hospitals, but there you are. John Lee has a good scoop in the Mail on Sunday. Part of the Sinn Féin alternative budget, the full text of which we will get during the week apparently, proposes that nobody would pay USC under €45,000, and over the five-year life of a government, that would cost us a mere snip at €2.5 billion. Separately, of course, Sinn Féin have said they want a special €1 billion fund for poorer communities, and this is part of a competition between all the parties, both the parties in government and Sinn Féin out of government, trying to persuade us of the differences and why their differences is better than the other difference. But what hits me very forcibly are not differences. It is the same splurge of spending. All the parties in government and in opposition are in lockstep in a programme of spending that is far above what is safe or prudent.
So, actually, this is something that struck me last week when Aidan O'Regan was here on the panel. Do we have a left wing or a right wing anymore then? Because, you know, before you would have had a party saying, you know, we need to spend less money, have smaller government. That was kind of the dichotomy. Is it now between people who are vaguely centrist, who all agree that we should spend loads of money on everything, and then you have extremes? Is that the alternative?
The only significant difference I can find between the main parties on economic policies is their preferred words. So for some people, centre is a very preferred word, and they like to own that word, and it's, you know, historic to their former prudence, which is now a distant memory. Others like to talk about justice, but it's all money. It's all billions. And I mean, the scale of it is simply extraordinary. It's all about diminishing the tax base. So, for example, cutting inheritance.
But if we have massive surpluses every year, are they not taking too much tax off people?
But hold on a sec, you know, the degree of corporation...
Is that not simple maths?
No, it's not
simple
maths.
If they're ending up surprised every year with millions, I know some of it's windfall, but if they're ending up surprised by billions every year, does that not mean they're taking too much money in the hated USC?
Not in those simple...
And then trying to think of ways to spend it?
In those simple terms, absolutely not. And that is lethally dangerous, because the problem with our tax take is not the amounts of money we're taking, it's where we're getting that money from, it's how reliable and how sustainable that money is, how long we may continue to have it. It is a fact that our Irish Fiscal Advisory Council tells us that if we discounted corporation tax, which we cannot rely on in the short or in the longer term, we're looking at a deficit of over two billion. We're looking at corporation tax that accounts for 27% last year. It's probably a bit more now of all our tax. Of the 27% that accounts for all our tax, I think about three big companies account for nearly 40% of that.
Yeah.
So that's how we're getting all this money. It's not safe.
Daniel
it's
Murray
not prudent.
Has a piece in the Business Post today, which is kind of counterintuitive, right, to what we all think. He's saying that this is actually going to go up, probably, as there are tax breaks on IP here, which are going to diminish. Is this correct, Dan? And they're going to diminish. There'll be more money coming in off them for the time being.
The tax rate goes up to 15% proper. So that will make a difference as well. No, I mean, look, before the last crash, we were overly dependent on stamp duty revenue, which of course evaporated right away, and we got into trouble fiscally. There's a piece in the Sunday Business Post by Ian Guider basically saying now is no time to party like it's 2006.
He says there's a bang of late stage Celtic Tiger off the atmosphere.
He sets out a warning, says surely we've learned our lessons, and maybe we haven't. But look,
they're talking about a soft landing in America, which I think made everybody in earnest.
It's very difficult to resist the lure of being able to give a windfall budget to the electorate 2 or 3 months before, you know, the major national election coming up. So yeah, I mean, I can see where politicians are in a dilemma, but there clearly are people who are arguing that we shouldn't throw fuel on the fire. We shouldn't further heat the economy because of the risk that we might face a serious
lonely people like
bump.
Ian Guider and IFAC, and like, is anyone listening?
Nobody's listening. But our wages in our country are now rising by over 9%. And that is money chasing costs. And in more money that is spent inflates those costs. The government says their budget will be so fantastic, we'll be €1,000 better off. The central bank has told us that were worse off by over €1,000 a year because of government spending that has inflated costs.
And I think Seamus Coffey and IFAC are saying the same thing.
Absolutely.
Sinead O'Carroll, there's a take on this in the Sunday Independent. Greens fight FF and FG to keep 560 baby boosts in budget. But like, the picture that's been painted there by Gerard, they are all fighting each other to can spend more money.
Who can spend more and who can get the headlines and who can make the people that they want to make feel better? Because this is short-termism because of what we started this conversation with, that there's an election coming up. So this is, and the polls are telling us that migration and immigration is now down in what is front of mind for people. It's cost of living, it's what's in their pocket. There's a headline in the Sunday Times about America, it's still the economy stupid. So instead of trying to get people excited about spending, you know, billions on infrastructure, like the AIB billions is going to Ishka Air and the LDA and the energy grid, that's not going to win anyone votes, although it should. Yeah. So what the Greens are hoping to do is 560 euro, so it's basically a quadruple payment of the child benefit for any first-time parents. The government don't want to, the other parties in the government or Fine Gael don't want to do this because they think it's not targeted enough, which you'd have to laugh because they want to do a double payment of the child benefit anyway. So I'm not sure how that's more targeted than
and on and on this will go for the next week.
So yeah.
Okay. All right. I need to take a break. Excuse me. Dan Mulhall, Sinead O'Carroll, Gerard Howland and Sinead McSweeney staying with us.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel is still with us. Dan Mulhall, Sinead O'Carroll, Gerard Howland and Sinead McSweeney. Dan, the Middle East, again at the precipice, it would seem, this weekend. Yep. You picked a piece in the Sunday Independent, Department block strike on Hezbollah kills three children. But just put that aside and give me your broad view on the situation.
It's maybe a small miracle that there hasn't already been a regional conflict in the Middle East following on from what happened in Gaza and the what happened in Israel and the attacks on Gaza by Israel over the last year. We're coming up to the first anniversary now of
when that. We say regional conflict, by the way, can we just, because I think some people don't know what that means. So, does that mean Iran
Iran and some of the other countries might decide to join in against Israel?
Yeah.
Now, it hasn't happened for the good reason that nobody wants it. It's not in Israel's interest to have a regional conflict. It's not in Iran's interest either, because they would probably end up in a direct conflict with the United States, which could have serious implications for them. But we now have Hezbollah attacking Israel, Israel launching major attacks into Lebanon.
Well, Hezbollah have been attacking Israel for a year now.
Yes, they have. There hasn't been an all-out war between Hezbollah and Israel, presumably because Iran, which is the major backer of Hezbollah, are restraining them and telling them not to do that. But Israel has now stepped up the pressure on Hezbollah. And the question is, will Hezbollah escalate this conflict further? And that could have really serious implications if that conflict were to spread beyond the localized and terrible things that are happening in Gaza. But they're localized, and so you could have an uprising on the West Bank. You could have other countries getting involved, and that would be a serious development which would destabilize the whole region and have consequences beyond the region. So I think the stakes are quite high. I have to say I'm surprised that the Americans haven't been able to rein in Israel more effectively over the last year, and they've allowed them to.
The Americans almost seem irrelevant at this stage, do they?
Well, I mean, they're supplying Israel with most of what it needs.
But their words of caution seem to be.
Yeah, I mean, they've been trying to broker a ceasefire, but that hasn't happened yet. Doesn't look like it's going to happen anytime soon. So what we have now is a conflict that's just going on, and with more and more people losing their lives in Gaza, and now in now in Lebanon as well. So it is, I think, very important that somehow this push to try and find some kind of solution to the crisis in Gaza, to broker a ceasefire. Because remember, the Israeli government's not very popular in Israel either. You have demonstrations on a regular basis against the Netanyahu government, which is not very popular in the United States, especially with Democrats. So it's also part of the U.S. election campaign. So we are at a very difficult moment
As a diplomat, can you see any diplomatic solution here, though? It seems like any kind of resolution is getting further away all the time, wasn't it? Like, you think of the innocent times a month ago where we thought we might be coming near a ceasefire.
There's always a diplomatic solution, but it's never easy, and it requires a lot of effort. And Tony Blinken, the US Secretary of State, is back and forth all the time. I'm sure the Americans are heavily invested on the ground, along with some of the Arab countries, in trying to find a way forward. But the problem is that you have an Israeli government that doesn't really want to play ball because it has its own reasons for wanting to press ahead. You've got trouble.
Netanyahu is basically in hock to these settler extremists who are in his government.
Exactly. And of course, like,
it's not all
and of course,
him,
the sort of activities of the settlers is causing more difficulty elsewhere, and therefore making a solution to the problem, a two-state solution, all the more difficult as they eat more and more into what is Palestinian land. So every year that goes by, the prospect of actually creating a Palestinian state becomes more difficult because of the expansion of settlements and the inability or the unwillingness of the Israeli government to rein in the settlers. And the settlers are getting more and more aggressive now in their activities. And, you know, there is bound to be a backlash there as well. And you could see a flare-up of trouble on the West Bank as well. You could see a further escalation of the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah. All of those things would be very bad, not just for Israel and Palestine, not just for the Middle East, but for the wider world as well. Remember what happened when the last major conflict occurred in Syria. You had millions of people fleeing, looking for refuge in Europe, and starting this whole issue about how we cope with the influx of people from other parts of the world in our societies.
Okay, and Israel ends up fighting on every front, basically, surrounded.
Well, I mean, look, Israel, we've seen this week that they are an extraordinarily you know, resourced country, that they could actually plant explosive devices into walkie-talkies carried by Hezbollah operatives. But that's a spectacular move on their part. It demonstrates just how capable the Israeli system is, but it doesn't solve the overall problem that Israel does need to broker a proper peace with its neighbours. The Americans, this time last year, before October, they were looking to actually broker a deal between Saudi Arabia and Israel. That's now gone out the window.
Which would have been fantastic for the region. Okay, I'd love to hear what the others think of that, but unfortunately, time is against us. But Dan, that was a great, clear snapshot of where we are at today. Thank you very much. And thank you to Sinead McSweeney, a former Global VP Public Policy Twitter and student, Gerard Howland, Public Affairs Advisor, Irish Times columnist, Sinead O'Carroll, editor of the Journal.ie, and Dan Mulhall, former Irish Ambassador to the United States.